The most dangerous place you can be as a trial lawyer is to think you've got it figured out.
I'm still trying to get better. I still have the passion for it. I believe in it.
Everyone can learn to do what I do.
And yet there's a group here that continues to get extraordinary verdicts.
Trial Lawyers University is revolutionizing educating lawyers to be better trial lawyers. It's been invaluable to me.
Trial Lawyers University, where the Titans come to train. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Good day, everybody. We got Ben Cloward with us from Las Vegas. And Ben and I go way, way back. Probably further back than, well, not than everybody, because Joe Freed and I go back actually 25 years. But Ben and I go back about 8 years. And he went to the Trial Lawyers College with a bunch of my friends. And Ben has a big significance, though, because he was at like the first Trojan Horse Method program in January of 2015. So, of course, I take a lot of credit for Ben's success. But Ben, tell us what your memories were of that first get together where I'm like, I got to start my own trial program. This Trial Lawyers College, it just ain't cutting it. I think I got a better idea than Jerry Spence.
Yeah, I remember it was in California, downtown LA, as I recall. I think there were, what, probably 15 of us, 10, 15 of us, something like
that. I was a little more popular than that. I think there was like 23 or 22, but that's okay. It was a small, it was intimate group. Remember, we rented the presidential suite. So like instead of having a conference room, we just had a big living room to meet up in.
Yep. It was awesome. Steve King was there. John Patrick Smith was there. There were a couple of lawyers from California that were there. And obviously you were there leading us. And it was awesome. It was very helpful in my progression as a trial lawyer.
Well, because that was my first take on things. And obviously I've been at it for like 8 years now or something like that, focused on this teaching or presentation skills and connection. But like that program, because you had just spent at the Trial Lawyers College, that was called the Spence Method, like, and then maybe a couple of years before, what were the skills like, the different than learning at Trojan Horse than you learned at Spence or at Trial Lawyers College?
Yeah, I think one of the main differences was a real focus on the presentation skills, how you deliver the message, how you connect, more maybe from a mechanical standpoint. A lot of the communication is oral, but a huge part of communication is nonverbal skills, body language, tone, those types of things. You know, only a small percentage are the actual words that we use. And in Trojan Horse, you know, you really focused on those other intangibles, like I guess the body language, the intonation, the tone of how you deliver certain things. And those are things that you can practice through repetition. You can get better using your hands, how you use your hands appropriately, the use of demonstratives, those types of things.
Well, and then Ben was just over last night, believe it or not, right here, even though that's the new dojo for Trial Lawyers University. And I was showing, it was the first time Ben's seen this new stuff that we developed since we started doing these boot camps that I've been doing for the last couple of years. But if you could just kind of like, hopefully there was some differences what you saw last night that there was 8 years ago when you did the first Trojan Horse. But of course, I don't have your perspective because I only have my perspective. So from your perspective, what did you see that was maybe different than what you remember?
I can see that you've really advanced. I mean, the differences are night and day. The skills are much more refined. I mean, I think Trojan Horse back in 2015, it was a great product, but it was raw. And you've spent the last 8 years plus really refining and perfecting the system. You have a very systematic approach of the way you like to do things. You have it chunked out into different modules, different skill sets. One thing that I know, I don't think we did a lot of, maybe we did a teeny bit back in 15, but you do quite a bit now, which I think is very helpful, is the proper use of demonstrative exhibits. I think a lot of people don't really understand the power of using those and how to use them appropriately. And I think that that's a skill that you've definitely refined quite a bit.
Yeah, we're making a lot of progress. I'm pretty excited about it. And actually, I'm super excited because Ben and I now go way back, but he was at actually the first Huntington Beach program we did back in 2022 with the Paris firm. And I was It was a smaller program, maybe around 250 people or so. You missed last year. I think you were in trial or something. But this year in Huntington Beach, we got a great conference coming up. I'm super stoked about it because we have taken over the whole hotel at the Paseo. And it's going to be the first time ever that we do a 7-day trial college with TLU. The first 3 days, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, June 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, are going to be my skills training boot camp for about 10 people. Then after that, those same students will get to learn at the rest of the conference. And that's where Ben comes in at the rest of the conference, June 5th and 6th. Ben has put together a 2-day masterclass on premises liability. And that's what we're going to talk about in a little bit. But before we do, I want to talk to Ben about how it is that he decided one day, got this big idea, I'm going to become a lawyer, because there was not a lot of lawyers in his family. So how did that come about, Ben?
So that's one of the, what I consider kind of the tender mercies of God. Just, it was a really, a very fortunate thing, kind of dumb luck, whatever you want to call it. I don't believe in luck. I think it was a blessing that I fell into that. I didn't know any lawyers growing up. I didn't have any family members that were lawyers, any neighbors, anybody that I knew. I didn't know any lawyer. And so it was not even on my radar. And I was in undergraduate. I was trying to plug through school, putting myself through school. And one of my best friend's dads was a plant manager at a fertilizer plant in Provo. And he gave us this really cake job, summer job, where we were on the maintenance crew. And we basically, you know, went around and did painting and sweeping and weed pulling, but we got paid like $25 an hour. I mean, it was, for a college kid, it was like awesome. And his son was a runner at a downtown firm in Salt Lake City. And he was telling me all these stories about how the lawyers would get on the elevator and they would be talking, telling about all these cross-examinations and closing arguments and how they were turning the screws on some witness on a cross-exam. And I was like, man, that sounds really cool. And it got me thinking about law school. And he had done the research to figure out what it takes to go to law school, do the LSAT, this and that. So I started thinking, man, I could probably do that. And then around that same time, my friend's uncle had a tragic accident where he lost his life. The defense would call it a tragic accident, but he hired a great lawyer in Utah, a guy by the name of Alan Young, who's a friend of mine. We've litigated cases together. And Alan represented the family, and it was a fireworks stand that blew over and hit my friend's uncle in the head, and it killed him. And Alan was able to show through discovery, a lot of efforts, that had happened before with that company. Not, it hadn't taken somebody's life, but those things had blown over many, many times before. And so he was able to get a sizable recovery for the family and really provide. They had young kids, several young boys, and poor wife is left husbandless, the kids fatherless. And I just thought, man, that is a noble calling. And so those two things kind of intersected at that time in my life. And it was just really a blessing that that happened, because I feel like I'm kind of made for being a trial lawyer.
So you come up with this idea that you have to become a lawyer. So where do you go to school?
The first year, I didn't know really much about, you know, the law school. I didn't know that they accept people on a rolling basis, all of those things. So I took the very last LSAT that you could take in the year and started applying. And I only got into 2 out of, I think, 18 schools because I bombed the LSAT. Like, I scored like in the 50th percentile. And so I only got into 2 schools, Oklahoma City University and Tulsa. So I went to Tulsa University and I loved it there. It was an awesome experience, but we ended up transferring back to the University of Utah, and I graduated from the University of Utah.
And so when you graduate, so you said we, is that you and your wife?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so married pretty young. How old were you when you got married, if you're already married in law school?
I think maybe 20, 25-ish. I think something like that. I'm not real great with those kind of numbers.
Okay.
I know, right. My wife was young. She was 18 or 19. She was 18 when we met, 19 when we got married, so.
All right. It's good that you knew real quickly there in that kind of short little relationship. So you go and you finish the University of Utah and it's time to get a job. So where do you strike out to get your first job?
So there was a firm here in Vegas, a well-known firm. It actually was the firm that was started by Harry Reid 50 plus years ago. And they recruited from several schools in Utah. And I got a job offer from that firm to come down here to Vegas and do medical malpractice defense and kind of general negligence defense. And so that's where I started off.
Did you enjoy billing hours and representing corporations and protecting bad doctors? I'm just wondering.
I absolutely hated that. The billing hours was the worst, but I remember there was a client that a plaintiff that I was defending the case, and I dug through her medical records and pulled out all of these things in the medical records. And I remember calling the plaintiff lawyer and explaining like, hey, this is a bad case for you. Look at this and this and this. And, you know, you really should drop this. There's no way that this happened. And this lady had this pre-existing knee issue. And so he dropped the case. He withdrew from the case. And I remember getting a letter from her, and I still remember her name. I won't say it just for privacy reasons, but she wrote a letter to our firm, to me and my senior associate, and it was heart-wrenching. Like, she lays out her whole life of like how significant her life has changed as a result of this event. And I'm reading this and I'm just like, how in the heck am I doing this? Like, I got to be done with this. And that still is on my conscience. Like, I feel bad about that. So I decided at that point, like, I'm not going to represent companies anymore. This is stupid. And started looking for other opportunities.
And so what opportunity do you find?
Foray into the plaintiff work is I started with a big advertising firm in Las Vegas, the Richard Harris Law Firm. And I started there. Worked there for probably, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years.
Let's talk about those 6 or 7 years though. So you're working in a high volume marketing, you know, advertising law firm as a new associate with 9 months of experience. So what was that like for you?
I mean, my personality type was perfect for me because I'm not really afraid of many things. And so I was very aggressive and very eager to try cases. I think I tried my first case being there within 3 months. I did it solo. I don't think that was the smartest decision. The lawyer that was supposed to show up as my first chair didn't show up. And so I was there alone. And then within probably 3 or 4 years, I tried, I don't know, 10 or 12, 15 cases, something like that. I was trying on average anywhere between 4 and 5, 6 cases a year. And so it gave me a ton of experience early on, very quick. We were given 150 claims files and 50 litigated files. And it was sink or swim mentality. You kind of had to figure things out. You ran the cases on your own. It wasn't a team effort. It was just me and the paralegal. And I figured out real quick, and it was a great experience.
So how many years were you there for before you decided to venture out on your own?
I was there 2 different times. So I was there and then I went off on my own, started a firm called Cloward, Hicks & Brazier. And while I was at Cloward, Hicks & Brazier, me and my partner, Allison Brazier, got a $15 million verdict. And I was fortunate to receive the Trial Lawyer of the Year in Nevada for the NJA, Nevada Justice Association. And because of that result, Richard Harris asked me to come back as a partner and gave me a huge pay raise and gave me kind of an opportunity to oversee cases and do a lot more trials and focus on kind of the bigger cases that I wanted to focus on. It gave me an opportunity really to focus on the types of cases that I wanted to handle. And so it was kind of a no-brainer for me to take that opportunity. And I did take that opportunity and stayed there for probably about 5 years until
January 2023.
Yeah, January 2023. The end of 2022, I started to kind of decide, hey, look, I need to go out on my own. I settled a couple of really big cases and just figured, you know what, it's time for me to do my own thing, I'm giving away most of the fee on these cases.
Right. It's like, that's never fun to give away money unnecessarily.
Yeah.
And when you share fees necessary for people that, you know what I'm saying? When you all work on together, that's a different story, I can imagine. And so now you started your firm and you started that in January 2023 and had a pretty solid first year from what I've seen. So that's pretty exciting. I think I saw that you'd done, I don't know, like in your first year, you guys did like $112 million in, you know, settlements and verdicts.
Yep. $112 million. A big chunk of that was a $45 million arbitration award on a negligent security case. And we've had some big, big settlements, 20.25, one for 17, one for 11.8, 10.8. It's been incredible. 12.25. It's been insane.
You don't have to try cases anymore. They just pay you. It's even better. You get to have a nice, comfy life without having to work 14, 18 hours a day for 2 months in a row. This is great. This is great. Well, it's good that your firm's going great and that, you know, that your new venture, I'm sure that first venture with your partners for that time period was very helpful because there's so much going on when you're running your own firm and being the lawyer and
yeah,
a lot going on, but it's good that you're navigating that well. But let's talk about Huntington Beach because you put together a 2-day masterclass and the first day is on premises liability and the second day is on negligent security. So let's talk about this and break it down. And so the first hour, because that way people get a real, I want to give people a real overview of what you're going to be teaching so that they can make an informed decision if they would like to come and participate. And if it's going to change their life, like I believe it will, if they do these kinds of cases. So the first hour, you're talking about intake and an overview of cases. So tell us about that.
So, you know, one of the things that's been an incredible blessing here in Vegas, and especially working at the high volume firm for as long as I did, we had so many different case types. Like, it's just incredible the different ways that people get hurt here in Las Vegas. You have all these casinos and people come into town and just crazy things happen. I mean, you've got slip and fall cases, trip and fall cases. You've got people tripping over parking stops. You've got lighting cases. I mean, we've had a lot of elevator and escalator cases and just crazy things that happen. And I remember one case in particular, my client was riding the escalator up over Tropicana and his croc got stuck in the combs of the escalator. And so he pulls his foot out and steps on the hot base there. Well, he had neuropathy from a prior brain injury. He was a war vet. And so he doesn't sense that his feet are getting the crap burned out of them. And that burn leads to an infection. The infection leads to serious issues. They have to amputate part of his foot. And it's just crazy. So it becomes like this big case on the standards of care for maintenance of these combs. And there were several teeth that were broken off and there are ANSI standards and ASTM standards about when you need to replace and repair those. And so the first part of the case, or I guess the first hour, is just talking about all of the various types of cases. I mean, we've had ADA violation cases. A lot of the cases that we have are like false detention and false arrest cases where somebody's a little too liquored up at the casino and they get taken into security and, you know, get beaten up or withheld in security. And we've had a bunch of faulty furniture cases where somebody's on the chair, they're playing the slot machine and leaning back and the chair collapses. And then you come to find out, you do a bunch of discovery and they've had a whole bunch of those issues before. This is like the fifth or sixth or 10th time that this has happened. Pieces of furniture within the hotel, headboards falling off on people, crown moldings falling off on people. I mean, we've had just all sorts of crazy cases. And so we're going to talk about those and talk about some of the standards associated with those cases and discuss how to really win those cases, what you need to look for. I'm really excited. About 6 or 8 months ago, or actually it's coming up on about a year, I had one of my partners just join the firm, Riley Clayton, who was a 20-plus year attorney working as the defense lawyer for Caesar's Palace and for MGM. So he's got 20 years of experience defending those cases. And so it's going to be a really great 2 days discussing these cases and how to really build them up and what to look for, how to screen them and so forth.
Well, let's talk about that, like intake and pre-suit discovery planning. What are you going to talk about that?
So there are different types of theories of liability for a premises liability case. So you've got to have, in Nevada, the case law is that I think the misconception that the general public has is that if something bad happens on a property, then they're liable. And that's just not the case. That's not the case law. That's not the way that it works. You've got to prove certain things. And so we're going to talk about the theories of liability, you know, actual notice. What does it take to have actual notice, constructive notice, and implied notice? And we're going to talk about how you can prove those things. And we're going to talk about also how you can use your complaint as a discovery tool initially to discover some things right off the bat in their answer. When you complete certain things, it's almost like getting unlimited RFAs. And if you craft your complaint in a logical fashion, you can get a lot of admissions or denials right off the bat. And obviously, one of the really important things that we've found in Nevada with the casino cases is we have some very good spoliation law. If the casino or the property owner has any reason to believe that there's going to be litigation, they have an affirmative obligation to preserve evidence. But what we found is they usually only preserve like 6 seconds of the video. And unless you send a really solid spoliation letter outlining all of the reasons that you need for them to preserve a whole bunch of the video, then they usually get away with it. They usually, the judge will say, well, you know, they preserved the evidence, they preserved the video of the fall. I don't think they spoliated the evidence by not keeping an hour before or 2 hours before. And really, that hour before might be the event that shows where something happened to the premises that your client slipped on. That might be the actual notice that they had, and that's really the silver bullet for the case. So we're going to talk about the importance of that and how to properly set that up.
Well, after you get a little discovery done, now you got to try to look for your experts. So what kind of thoughts do you have on finding the right experts for your case?
So I want to go back just really quick to some of the discovery. So a lot of that was pre-suit, some of the things that you want to do pre-suit, preparing the complaint, sending out the spoliation letter. Those are things kind of, I guess, before you file the complaint. But then the important thing we're going to talk about is a Rule 30B6 deposition and how to use and maximize a 30B6 deposition during the discovery process. In my view, that is probably the number one discovery tool that plaintiffs have at their disposal. And if you're not doing a good 30B6 deposition, then you're probably not doing it right. You need to come and learn. You need to come and learn. If you don't learn it from me, go listen to Kaz, Mark. I can't pronounce his last name, Kaz.
Kazaratsky. He'll be here at Huntington Beach too. So we'll have access to other great lawyers there besides yourself. So we'll get access, get word from information from different folks.
Yep. Mark Kaz is a stud. Jay Vaughn talks a lot about 30B6 stuff. I mean, the thing that's awesome about TLU, Dan, I got to admit, is I learned something every single time, a golden nugget. Jay Vaughn, he's one of my favorite lawyers. He's such a stud out of Kentucky. I sat through one of his presentations and he does this thing in the 30B6. It's called the purple, where he'll go through the deposition and he'll ask him these questions and the deponent will be like, oh, well, I didn't look into that. And so Jay just says purple. And people are looking around like, what do you mean? But what he does is at the end of the deposition, he just runs a word search for the word purple and it comes up and all of these things where he has to follow up and then he sends him a letter. It's like the most ingenious thing. It's awesome. So I guess for the listeners, you're going to learn. I promise. Come to TLU, you're going to learn. It's just an amazing program that you do, Dan. Sorry, that's my little
side tangent.
Back
to expert. You were talking about the 30B6 and the actual discovery plan, not pre-suit.
Yeah. So one of the things here in Nevada that the casinos are just notorious for is hiding the ball. They do not want to turn over their prior incidents. And unfortunately, the case law in Nevada is developed that if it's a transient hazard, so if it's like water spill, something like that, then they don't necessarily have to turn over a whole bunch of prior incidents, unless you can link it to some sort of a system type of a failure. But if it's like, hey, it's a crack, then they've got to turn over the evidence. So we're going to talk about how you go about pleading it correctly to increase your probability that you're going to get a judge to agree that they need to turn over prior incidents, even if it is a transient hazard and those types of things.
All right. Now can we talk about expert witnesses?
Yes, sir.
All right. Tell us all about it. How to select them.
Well, I think the expert witnesses are probably, some people love experts, some people hate experts.
I think most people hate them.
Yeah. Because
they're so expensive and they kind of cancel each other out. But how do you feel about experts, Ben?
I think that if you have a good educator, experts are invaluable, especially on certain types of cases. Like a slip and fall or a trip and fall case, I think you've got to have a human factors expert to explain very basic things about eyesight and zones of vision and why somebody would trip or why somebody would slip or not see something on the ground. Like, here's a perfect example. Here's a nugget for the listeners that I learned 3 or 4 trials ago. I had a human factors expert, and she's phenomenal. She gave this to the jurors. I know that the jurors probably went home on their way home from work and did exactly what she explained and were probably had this epiphany. When you're looking at something, if you're focused on it, you can see the detail. But if you look even just 5 to 10% outside of that zone of vision, your perception of that and your ability to read that goes way, way, way down. And an example for the listeners is when you're driving into work, if you're listening to this on the way to work, or if you're driving home on the way home from work, at the car just in front of you, look at the stoplight. And while you're focused on the stoplight, try to read the license plate of the car in front of you. You would think, oh, well, geez, I can easily do that when I'm focused on this stoplight. It's only a foot away, but you can't. It's impossible. Listeners, they're going to realize that it's impossible. And that's something that when you start to explain those types of things to jurors and you start to give them examples like that, then they understand how somebody can trip over something if they're not focused and actually looking on the hazard. And that's something I think you've got to have an expert to kind of give some of those examples to show them, to educate them of like, oh yeah, your client wasn't just a dummy that tripped over their own feet or tripped over this crack or this hazard. This is something that, why we have safety standards to put up caution signs and wet floor signs and those types of things.
Now let's talk about pre-trial planning, especially about the importance of jury instructions and really getting your voir dire topics and your motions limines down.
Yeah. I wish that I could give myself credit for this. One of the things on the jury selection, but it's not my nugget to give. It's a Keith Mitnick trick, and it's one of the best voir dire ways to ferret out people with bias. And I feel like I've improved on it just a little bit. It was already excellent to begin with. But what I do is I start and I ask the jurors in voir dire, I think it's important to have them self-identify the types of lawsuits that they feel are frivolous. Okay, so I ask them, hey, who here has heard of a frivolous case? And everyone talks about McDonald's, right? We've all had that in jury selection. What I do is I get a butcher paper and I ask people, tell us, ladies and gentlemen, let's list all of the types of frivolous cases. They're going to list, you know, fender bender. They're going to list slip and fall. Pardon me. And so I write that down there and get them to identify a slip and fall case, because 99 out of 100 veneers are going to agree that a slip and fall is a frivolous type of a case. People just believe that. They've been indoctrinated. So then I get people to raise their hands. Who here also agrees? You identify those people. So that's my way of identifying bias. And then Keith Mitnick's, which I think is awesome, is saying to the jurors, saying, hey, ladies and gentlemen, when somebody has a trip and fall event, and I'm asking, you know, the listeners, go listen to Keith to find out exactly the way to do it. I'm just summarizing, but it's basically, who here believes that when somebody has a trip and fall or slip and fall, that the plaintiff is always just a little bit at fault? And you see hands go up. I mean, you see so many hands go up, and that leads to a great cause challenge, because they're already, doesn't matter what the facts or evidence is, they're already thinking that your client is somewhat at fault no matter what. And so I kind of use those two methods, and we're going to practice that at TLU Beach. We're going to give people, you know, an opportunity to kind of practice that a little bit and show how that's done, and then show how that can lead to a cause challenge to get people off your panel that may already have a negative mindset or a negative view toward that type of a case.
All right. But also, you talked about jury instructions and stuff like that too at this phase. Is that right? I mean, that's something to start thinking about.
Yes, definitely. So I kind of mixed those up. I talked about hour six instead of talking about hour five.
I know you did.
You're always
keeping
me online, my man. I appreciate it. You're always...
My job.
Yeah, that's right.
Crack the whip.
So knowing the law is critical. And if you do a deep dive on your law in your state, you'll find that the law is actually usually very plaintiff friendly. I mean, we have great case law here in Nevada that talks about how, you know, it's a jury instruction we give. It's a case that we found that says something along the lines of, it's not reasonable for a plaintiff to walk around with their eyes down at the ground all the time. And it's acceptable and reasonable for them to walk around not looking down at the ground at all time. And then there's another case that we found that talks about how sometimes people will see something, but then they'll forget about it. That's reasonable. That case was about a gentleman that walked into a casino and he saw a sign that had a base that protruded out. He saw it. And then things were busy, the line started forming, and as he's moving along the line, he forgets about it and trips over it. And the jury instruction was like, you know, that's fine, but you need to warn guests of those types of things. And so it kind of explained away his negligence that, hey, look, this is a normal part of human behavior, and having the law nailed down in your state, having the law nailed down, the jury instructions is really critical, because it's usually generally plaintiff friendly. Like I said, there are things that explain away your client. And then it obviously talks about the duties of what a landowner is supposed to do in order for them to be reasonable.
Let's talk about, well, you want to get back to hour six. We talked about voir dire, but what are your thoughts on the other parts of trial, the opening and the sequencing of evidence and stuff?
My thought always has been that you've got to focus heavily on the defendant's conduct. Before I ever talk about my client, before I really even introduce my client's story, anything like that, I try to devote 2/3 of the time to talking about the defense and talking about their conduct. That's a critical thing in my view of telling the story and getting your story out there and framing things for the jurors to explain the bad conduct. And then obviously closing arguments, you need to really understand the jury instructions and how to argue the jury instructions in a way that you can apply the evidence and the law in a way that makes sense. And a lot of times people don't really do that. They talk about their closing, they talk about the facts, they restate the facts, but they don't argue in the law and how the law applies and how recommitting the jurors, continually recommitting, you know, ladies and gentlemen, you all agreed that you would follow the law. Well, here's what the law says. The law says X, Y, Z, and the facts of this case are X, Y, Z, and this is why we win, and this is why if you follow the law, we win. And so we're going to be talking about doing that as well.
All right. Besides doing this premises cast, we're also doing a webinar on April 3rd on the Greyhound case with the handicap fella you were talking about earlier?
No. So that case that you and I were talking about, I think offline, was the $15 million verdict. My client was 51 years old. He was mentally disabled, and he was on a paratransit bus here in Nevada. Charles Allen and I and Allison Brazier tried that case. And on the paratransit bus, they were required to watch these folks with these intellectual, physical, emotional disabilities, and they were not allowed to eat because of the problems that come from that. If you're disabled, and he choked, he started to choke, and the bus driver didn't know what to do, didn't know how to help him. And so he actually ended up choking to death. And we found in that case that they had removed 3 pages of the safety manual, safety policy, safety training, to save like $40,000 on a $300 million contract. That's that case. The Greyhound case was a case that I litigated with Alan and Tyler Young out of Utah. They brought me in on the case. It was very grateful for the opportunity to work with those two guys. They're stud lawyers in Utah. We filed it here in Vegas because the driver lived here in Vegas and the two clients lived here in Vegas. And the crash happened up in Utah, but the Greyhound driver fell asleep and drove off the bus off of 70 miles an hour and ran into a cliff. And we were able to show that the driver had sleep apnea, that they had a whole bunch of warning signs about that, and that they really missed it. And they hired this guy, even though their internal hiring policies required them to send him out for further studies. And so we're going to be talking about that case. That case settled for $27.5 million.
What happened to the people on the bus?
So one fatality, a little girl died tragically. And our clients sustained, two of the clients, we had three clients, two of the clients sustained mild traumatic brain injuries, one actually a moderate traumatic brain injury, and then significant orthopedic injuries as well, neck and back. One of my clients suffered a really significant leg injury and PTSD. It was a nasty crash. It was a really nasty crash.
Well, if you can't attend to these case analysis when they're live, great news is they're all recorded and on TLU On Demand. And so you can watch them from your iPhone or computer, wherever you want. And we also give everybody, as a subscriber to TLU On Demand, the pleadings, the PowerPoints, and the transcripts for all these cases that we're talking about, because it's helpful to have a little roadmap when you're figuring out cases, especially as you start to get into these things. But also, it's always great, no matter how much experience you have, to look at what other people have done, because it gives you new ideas, which is, you know, what this is all about. That's why it makes this being a trial lawyer thing kind of fun. Always new puzzles to solve, new sort of games to play of solving these puzzles. Flip back, though, before we move on to negligent security, the paratransit bus, because you got this $15 million verdict. And was that your first eight-figure verdict?
Yes, it was.
Was it exciting? Because the way you're saying it was not, it doesn't sound that exciting, but I'm just saying.
It was awesome. I mean, it was everything that I'd been working for, everything that that's what you dream of, right? And it was a phenomenal result. The thing that was really the best part about that case, though, was that we were able to use those results and that kind of publicity around that verdict and able to go to the legislature in 2017 and have them pass a law called Harvey's Law that mandated all paratransit companies in the state of Nevada to have this safety training. Because what we found during that trial is that they had removed pages 68, 69, and 70 from the training manual. This is a global company. The company is, I think, First Group, and they owned First Transit. And this is the company that owns like Greyhound. I mean, it's a giant global company. And to save literally $42,000, $45,000, something like that, they removed these 3 pages from the manual because there was no Nevada law that required them to do this basic safety training. It was repulsive. And we were able to change the law so that now if you're a paratransit company here in Nevada and you're providing transportation to people with physical, mental, or emotional disabilities, you have to do this safety training, period, end of story. Because even in that case, the driver was, you could tell he felt just completely hopeless. It was all on video, and you watch the video, and you can see the dismay, and he just didn't know what to do. And on examination, you know, the poor guy is like, I would have done anything to save him. I just didn't know what to do. They had the training. They just removed it. That's why we do what we do, Dan. Hold companies like that responsible.
Not only hold it responsible, but forcing change for society, which has got to be a pretty good feeling, I would imagine.
Yes.
To help so many people that you'll never meet, that will never know what you did for them, but still making better changes for our society. But let's move on to negligent security, because you're going to do one day on negligent security. So how does that negligent security day start off on June 6th at 9 o'clock in the morning after an amazing breakfast out on the ocean with bacon and eggs and everything? Because you weren't there, but one time they didn't have bacon and I was very upset about that. I couldn't believe anybody would start their day without bacon. So instead they had gluten-free pancakes. And so I had a long talk with my event coordinator. I'm like, gluten-free pancakes, bacon. They are not the same. They're not even the same. It's not like he gave me pork sausage, which still would not be a good substitute, but it wasn't even close. But anyway, so at 9 o'clock after a full breakfast, because that's one of the great things about Huntington Beach, it's at a phenomenal hotel. We bought out the entire hotel and the food's phenomenal.
Yep.
From 7:30 to 9, we got breakfast. From 12:30 to 2, we got lunch. Almost everybody's there. And then we got theme parties every night. I know you're psyched. He told me for the Ken and Barbie theme party because people often mistake you for Ken. I understand how that could happen. And then on Wednesday, on Friday night, we're going to have a Western themed cowboy up party. And then on Saturday night, I think we're doing a TBI program in a legal med program in Austin, Texas next February.
Nice.
So of course we have to have a theme party to promote the upcoming conference. I mean, what kind of person would not do that? But then, of course, Saturday night, we have a live band, karaoke, but it's going to be Vegas night because, well, it's such a cool town we live in here. And we're doing this awesome conference at Caesars Palace, October 16th through 19th. So we got to have a Vegas night. So that's all the reasons more why people should be in Huntington Beach. And there's only like maybe 55 rooms left at the hotel. And so some people will not be at the main hotel that decide to delay their registration, but that is the choice people make. But when people get to that first hour on, it would be Thursday morning, what have they got looked forward to, Ben, on the negligence security?
I had a verdict in, we're going to be talking about that case in particular in one of the segments, but that was, it provided a great opportunity for me. That verdict opened a lot of doors for other people to bring me negligence security cases. And so we've kind of developed a little bit of a niche practice in this area. And it is a complicated, it's a complex area of law. The hope is that if the listeners come and attend the workshop, they're going to get everything that we know about this area of law, because it is different than just a regular slip and fall type of a case. It is very specific. The law is different. There's usually specific laws with respect to a negligent security case and different things that you've got to prove. We're going to be going over that in multiple different examples of cases. So the first thing that we're going to talk about is screening the case. What is a good case? What is not a good case? Because a lot of times with these negligent security cases, the first blush of the case, it might not seem like a great case, okay? The $38 million verdict case that I had, if you look at the intake summary was, young man was at the weekly budget hotel to see a girlfriend at 5 a.m. and was shot by some gang members. And you look at that case on its face, you look at that, and also it was, he may have been intoxicated and the girl may have been a prostitute. And so you look at that just on its face and you're like, doesn't sound like a good case, right? But then when you meet the family, you meet the mom, and it's just, this is such a beautiful family. What was taken from them? How can you not just immediately love this family and want to dig into it? And then you start doing just some very basic research on that property, and you find out, oh my gosh, this place, it's a crime-ridden. I mean, my gosh, there's shootings here, shootings there, shootings. All of these prior news articles are just popping up, boom, 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 left and right. So you do a little bit of research on this place, and now all of a sudden it's like, well, this isn't a bad case. This is a phenomenal case. You just need to focus properly on the defendant's conduct rather than on the plaintiff's conduct. And we were actually able to show through discovery that all of these things that the defense tried to throw mud at our clients just weren't true. This was a friend that he had been seeing. He met at a bar, and you know, had been over there several times. She wasn't a prostitute. None of these things that the defense was trying to sling mud stuck.
Got it. All right. And then we got the second hour. What are we going to go into the second hour?
Yeah. One other thing I want to touch on the hour one that's super duper important is you have to, then probably one of the very most important things when you're screening the case, you've got to understand the insurance right away, because there are sub limits and limitations on insurance in these cases, assault and battery sub limits, that if it's a gun limitation, those types of things, you may have a $30 million insurance policy, but it's limited to $50,000 if a gun was used. So that's one other thing that we're going to be talking about in hour one, is the significant importance of drilling down very quickly on these cases to understand the insurance coverage. And then hour two, we're going to be talking about a specific facts of a case. It was a $17 million settlement that we got. And there's negligent hiring, negligent training, negligent supervision cases. And this case was a negligent training case. And the thing that's going to be neat about the one-day masterclass on negligent security is that we're going to drill down on each of those sub areas of the hiring, the training, the supervision. This was actually a training and a supervision case where this guy was given a gun, was allowed to go and be a security officer and range around, and he ended up actually shooting and killing our client, the security guard did. So it was just a crazy case the way that it happened. We're going to talk about all of the things that we found out, all the depots that we took, all the depots that you should take, and the things that you should look for in this type of a case.
This is really great because every hour you're breaking down a different settlement, arbitration, award, or verdict. So it's like you're teaching these concepts and these skills in the context of a case. And I'm guessing a lot of these settlements are confidential, so you're able to teach on them without breaking that confidentiality in a meaningful way. So that's pretty cool.
Yep.
Because the third hour, you have a $10.85 million settlement on it against an apartment complex. What's that hour about?
Yep, we do. And this one was not confidential.
Oh, great.
We will be able to talk about the apartment complex and all the parties in this case. And in this one, it was our clients came to the apartment complex. They were there to provide some food to a family member that was struggling with cancer. And there was kind of a fight that broke out, and they got sucked into the fight, and our client ended up getting shot. And this one is, we're going to focus on other ways of finding critical information. Sometimes you'll just go out and you'll request calls for service. And you might think that the calls for service, you're casting a wide enough net to gather the information. But in this case, what we learned is that Metro had actually had several other interactions with this property owner. And so that data, you would never obtain that data if you're just requesting calls for service. So you have to specifically go to Metro to ask for other types of information, communication. And we found in this case that Metro had sent letters to this company saying, hey, we think you're a chronic nuisance. We think that you're having these continued problems because you're not following our recommendations and you're not listening to the advice that we're giving. So our star witnesses in this case were going to be, you know, some of the Metro officers and the lawyer for Las Vegas Metro. And so we're going to talk a lot about how you can prove a case against the management company, because this was a big settlement with the management company and the apartment complex and the security company. We're going to talk a little bit about the different types of theories for those different types of defendants, because they're all unique. The theory for the management company is unique. It's got its own experts. The theory for the security company is unique. It's got its own experts. And obviously the apartment complex, it's got its own experts.
All right. How about hour four? What's that case about?
So hour four, our client was choked to death at a property, excessive force case. And we're going to be talking about early on how to use, we feel like this also was a training and retention case. So we're going to be talking about the experts for an excessive force case, the experts that we had, our particular case, and how we were able to use those experts to really, I think, leverage the result that we got. And then I think also we're going to spend a lot of time just talking about the 30B6 deposition and the importance of that deposition. And the importance of that deposition as compared to the depositions of just the employees and what the employees were doing and what they should have done, what they should have been trained on, and how we were able to use that disparity of what the 30B6 said, hey, this is what they should have done versus, hey, this is what they actually did do. Kind of the Miller mousetrap, Philip Miller's mousetrap, using that trick.
He'll appreciate the shout out.
Hey, he's a stud, man. He's a great guy.
He's a great guy. He's coming too. Him and Justin Kahn and Ed Sarambulli are doing a 3 hours on Thursday morning. I can't remember what it is. I think he's talking about depositions, but I know they're doing a 1-day deposition masterclass on Wednesday, June 5th. So that's giving you some competition there for people that just want to learn about depositions and maybe don't care about premises liability.
Yeah,
because
maybe
depositions are a little more general. Maybe. So hour five is the $45 million arbitration award. That sounds like an arbitration. Tell us about that case.
So this was it's also non-confidential. And this was a tragic case. A young lady, 27 years old, I think. She was shot and paralyzed from about T11 down. And the apartment complex, we were able to show significant lapses in their overall security plan, significant warnings, major events that they were warned about, and they just didn't take action. They didn't take the steps that they needed to take. And in particular, in this case, this one is going to be tied with the $38 million verdict case. It actually was the same defendant. And this was one of the things that we learned in about the insurance coverage, why it's important to understand the lay of the land early on, and limitations and how you can get around limitations, creative ways that you can get around limitations in insurance. This one had a sublimit on the $1 million policy. The property owner changed coverage from step one to step two, and we were able to get an assignment. And now we're litigating a deck action failure to procure coverage case in a subsequent case in federal court regarding these damages here. So kind of ways to get around it, even if there is problem with the insurance, how you can still get there.
All right. And then finally, hour six is the $38 million verdict you were talking about against the same defendant.
Yep.
And so you kind of had it, but that was a jury trial. So
yep.
Tell us about that.
So this one, we're going to talk a lot about big data. We used big data multiple different times through the discovery process, but also through the jury selection process. We used a company called Jury Analyst. I've also used John Campbell and his group. There's also a group out of California that's a good group. And we're going to talk about how to use big data to frame your story, how to figure the sequencing of the story, how to figure out the best way to tell a story to get the maximum damages, and also the reduction of liability on your client and the reduction of liability on people that you don't want it to be on. I mean, at the end of the day, the property owner didn't pull the trigger. The security guard didn't pull the trigger. These were gang members that were in prison that pulled the trigger. But the way that we used big data to sequence the story, we learned, hey, story A, when we tell this fact first and this fact last, this actually leads to a better result with lower liability finding on these random strangers that killed our client versus this story over here. If we tell it this way, then people are attributing way more fault to them, which is clearly going to reduce the verdict and the percentages on the party that you want it to be on. And at the end of the day, we feel like the property owner was the true villain in this case because our client was the sixth person that was shot and killed or was killed at that property. Two other people were beaten to death and several other people were shot and killed. Several people were shot and paralyzed. And so we really felt like that the villain, really, truly the responsible party was the property owner. And so we wanted to hone the story to really maximize the the finding of liability for him. And we use big data to help us to do that.
Let me ask you though, I didn't ask you like at the first Huntington Beach thing, because that was back in 2022 at the Paseo. So well, tell us about your, what was your best memories of that event?
I was fortunate. You gave me an opportunity to present there. That was a great experience to present. But I think just the networking opportunity that you meet all of these lawyers from throughout the nation, you become friends with these lawyers and you see them at other events and you begin to just get valuable connections. I mean, I've had several cases referred to me through my connections with TLU lawyers, and I've learned. I mean, every time I go to an event, I went to the TLU Huntington Beach in 2022, but also if you remember, you did Panish Trial College. And I also went to that college, and that was a great experience to listen to Brian Panish and Rahul Ravapudi and others present. And at the first TLU event, it was Rex Paris and his firm did a lot of presentation and learning from Rex. And I mean, just the amount of information that you learn from these masters who've been doing this for 30, 40 years, guys like John Romano, Keith Mitnick, Nick Rowley, Sean Claggett. I mean, you have really some stud trial lawyers coming and presenting and learning from those people. I mean, the boot camp that you do, the skills that you present, you learn no matter what. You get better no matter what. I mean, unless you come there and you sit on the front row and you sleep the whole time, you're going to learn. Or if you sit in your room the whole time, I mean, if you come, you sit there in the chair and you listen, you're going to learn something. I guarantee it.
Well, and it's a lot more than just sitting in a chair, though, because we get up and get to do stuff, too, in the workshops, which is fun stuff. And this year, too, even in Huntington Beach, we have a lot of folks coming who've never been to TLU before, like Ben Rabinowitz out of New York, Sagi Shaked out of Miami, Steve DeBosier and Chad Dudley. I think you know those guys out of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And there's quite a few more. It's like the people. So that's how I'm really excited too, because then you get these perspectives from different great trial lawyers from around the country and what their thoughts are. But the networking is awesome, especially we have the whole hotel and people are there for 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
And Nave Ann Ward out of Atlanta for the BZ Allen firm is coming. He was the past president of the AAJ. So he's a great guy. I see him at all these conferences. So I'm just really looking forward to this. And then also that you were also in Vegas for both of our Vegas events, weren't you, for 2021 to 2022?
Yep, I was.
And we're gonna do that this year. So just like from your memory, how is like Vegas different than, besides the fact you're home, but different than the Huntington Beach one?
I think it's just bigger. It's, I mean,
it's
look.
Way bigger.
I don't want to minimize TLU Huntington Beach because it's an amazing, amazing event. But Vegas is like TLU Beach on steroids, I think. It's just, everything is just bigger. There's just more presenters. There's more going on. There's more people. It's incredible. It's really incredible.
Yeah. I'm really excited this year because we have our first Business of Law track in Vegas. So a lot of focus on AI and how people are using AI to do more stuff in their practice, to run things better. I don't really know about this stuff because I'm not that's not my thing. But my partner, Matt, that works with me here, he's all into that stuff.
Nice.
And so that's going to be exciting because in Vegas, we're going to have 8 lecture tracks and 21 workshop tracks.
Wow.
Whereas Huntington Beach is going to be 4 lecture tracks and 8 workshop tracks. So it is going to be quite a bit bigger and it's not on the ocean. That's a big difference too. And I can look out my window every day and I see Caesar's Palace. So it gets me fired up. So Ben, I'm going to end this conversation with 2 questions. First question is, in your whole career, what's the one moment that brings this one moment that you're most proud of as a trial lawyer?
That's hard.
I know. That's why I ask hard questions. That's why I'm like the Larry King of podcast, asking the tough questions.
I think I would have to, it'd have to be 2. I think one, and I've already talked about it, is getting Harvey's Law passed. Changing the law in Nevada for folks with disabilities is a huge thing. Another one, it was not a big result. It was not a big settlement. I mean, it was a $300,000 result, so it's not earth-shattering. But it brings me a lot of satisfaction because it was a homeless guy and he was really taken advantage of by a guy that lives 20 miles out of Vegas, out in a town called Moapa. He brings this guy out there, my client Dale, brings him out there and he's really using him as slave labor. You know, he's feeding him hot dogs and beer to do all the slave labor stuff. And he's having him build this thing. And the structure that he builds because he doesn't have any experience doing this. He's just doing what the guy's telling him to do. It falls over and crashes on him and really hurts him. And the policy was $300,000. We got the $300,000 policy limit, but we were able to structure the fees to where it provided him like $1,200 a month or $1,500, whatever it was, where he could get a weekly hotel, stay. It took him off the street. So he had a roof over his head. He had like $500 a month to spend on food and stuff. And it just changed his life. I mean, periodically he'll call and tell me, you know, how grateful he is. And those are the things, cases like that, where we're able to change someone's life, not just like, hey, here's $20,000, $30,000 type of thing, but you actually change somebody's life. And we had a case just recently that we settled for a lot of money, 20 plus million, and our client was able to retire. That's something to feel very, very proud of, right? The client is working and she has like 8 or 9 more years for retirement, and now she's retired. That's cool. I mean, I'm proud of that. I'm proud of being able to literally change people's lives.
It is an exciting thing we could do that. I got an email and a call this morning from this attorney out in Baltimore, EJ Hannah, and she just got, thanks to her and her partner, Chris, came to TLU New York and they did Lloyd Bell's Med Mal class. They did my 1-day class on presentation skills. And she just got her first verdict as a plaintiff's lawyer, which was $8.3 million on a Med Mal case. So she's just so happy and to be able to do that and hear somebody's joy. Both, you know, for me, it's both obviously clients matter, but for me, it's the lawyers that I get to know, right? Who struggle, you know, it's just a struggle. It's a hard business. It's a hard job figuring this stuff out. It takes so much commitment, so much work. It's insane. And so when I hear stories like this, she's going to do hopefully a webinar on with Lloyd Bell sometime in the next couple months, hopefully before Huntington Beach. So I was really excited about that. But my last question is this, Ben, what's your trial lawyer dream? The one thing that you haven't done yet in your career that it's like, it's in your head. It's like, I am looking forward to this day. I know. Besides, if you could just say it, because a lot of people would say it's my my first 9-figure verdict would be that day. But that's kind of superficial. So I don't know if that's it. But that could be it, though. Because I know that as you get bigger verdicts, that's something internally we compete with ourselves. But I was just wondering what yours was.
Obviously, numbers and trying to beat the prior year, get the high watermark. So yeah, that is something. $100 million settlement or verdict would be incredible. But I think something that I have yet to have happen is I want to actually force a company to make a change. I changed the law. I kind of caused the company to be required to, but I want to have such a result that the company actually internally says to themselves, hey, look, we want to change the way that we're doing this. There's a great firm out of Chicago, the Power Law Firm, and they had a giant settlement against 7-Eleven. It was a parking bollard case, and their client was pinned up against the wall because they were able to show that 7-Eleven knew about this. It was happening like once a day type of a thing.
A parking bollard? What is that? I don't know what that is.
It's like something in front of the parking stall that if the car is kind of run away or if someone hits the gas instead of the brake, instead of hitting the side of the building, it hits a bollard and it stops it. Okay. So it's like it's just a big pole, metal pole.
Do they often paint them yellow?
Yeah.
Now I know what you're talking about.
Paint them yellow, paint them red, paint them whatever color. But, you know, I roll up to my 7-Eleven store 2 months ago and I see them digging out and cutting holes and installing these parking bollards in front of the 7-Eleven store. I mean, I guarantee that settlement that they got against 7-Eleven was the cause of that change. And to me, that is the epitome of what we do. You're increasing the safety of that situation for all Americans throughout the United States. And that is something that I think is really cool that I have yet to have happen. It's like a company making a systematic company-wide change. That's pretty cool.
That would be pretty cool. All right, Ben. Well, this is the end of our visit. And I know I'll see you frequently here before Huntington Beach, but Thanks for stopping by, and we got a lot more to do.
All right, my man. I appreciate the opportunity. Looking forward to Huntington Beach. Hope we get a lot of people there.
Oh, there's going to be lots of people. There'd probably be total 700 to 800 people, would be my guess, because there was like 600 last year. So we'll see.
Nice. All right. Thanks, Dan.
Ready to train with the Titans and set records with your verdicts? Register for our live conferences and boot camps at triallawyersuniversity.com. Start getting your reps in before the big event by going to tluondemand.com to gain instant access to live lectures, case analysis, and skills training videos from the trial lawyer champions you love and respect, as well as pleadings, transcripts, PowerPoints, and notes for a roadmap to victory. Join the group that continues to get extraordinary results. Trial Lawyers University, produced and powered by LawPods.